Today on An Incomplete History, we're going to be talking about Prohibition. A lot of people have been talking about the 1920s, it being 100 years since 1920, reminiscing about how great the 1920s were, and they kind of forget this little thing called Prohibition. Today, we're going to talk about that. We're going to delve into where Prohibition came from, why it seemed to be embraced initially by the entire country, and why it was quickly kind of discarded, at least culturally. We're going to talk about how it ended. We're also going to talk about long-term effects of Prohibition. So 100 years ago, the 18th Amendment went into effect. How did that change lives of people back in the 1920s? How does it still change our lives today? Welcome to An Incomplete History.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Jeff.
And we're your hosts for this weekly history podcast.
So, Prohibition.
We've been waiting to do this one for a while.
I think we love this topic. I think we both really like this.
I do. Yeah, I think it's going to be a fun one because, I mean, I think it's something that people know about loosely, but we don't really think about the repercussions of it still today or like where it came from. And to revisit it, I think is going to be an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
So how are you doing?
Pretty good. Not too bad. Still getting in the swing of things. Juggling the couple of campuses and teaching and all that good stuff. Yeah. It's kind of jarring. I teach both freshmen and then I teach upperclassmen. And it's very jarring to go between the two groups.
That's pejorative to call them freshmen.
Why is that?
I don't know. We can have a conversation about that later.
I did. I think you remember a few years ago, I did have a student who was really offended.
Oh, yes. I know. That's why I just needled you about it.
And I was like, what do you want me to? I mean, tell me what you want me to call you. I'll call you that. But, you know, explain to me. I understand men is in the thing. But I think the student got offended when I said, well, what about first year? No, that was unacceptable as well. And I was okay, whatever.
I'm not sure what paradigm we're operating.
People who have just entered college. I don't know. Yeah.
Anyway, it is hard to have so many different levels that you're teaching. So right now I'm teaching intro to gender studies, which is intro level seminar for undergraduates. And then I'm teaching grad level seminars. And just the difference is so profound between understanding what we're talking about and just changing gears like that can be challenging. Yeah. But I like it, but it's a whole new shift in the way that I go about teaching. So
right. Well, it's also interesting when you're teaching the humanities or something and you're doing two texts and one of them you're doing one text but with two different groups. In one group, you're doing an intro level analysis of the text. And the other group, you're doing a very kind of deep thing. And it's sometimes I forget which one is which. And my first years will look at me like, what are you talking about? And I was oh, yeah, that's right. But, you know, that's the challenge there. So you just got back from Memphis.
Yeah, it's been a totally packed day. I've been up since 5:30 and I've had so many things going on. And then I went to Memphis to go shopping because you can't go grocery shopping in Oxford because the best grocery store is a Walmart. And I just can't do that for larger shopping trips. So I drove to Memphis.
So much for that Walmart. So much for that Walmart sponsorship, Hillary. You just kiss that money goodbye.
It's out the window now. Yeah. Well, I mean, I do have
Target.
To shop
we're
there
still
sometimes.
Interested in you.
We don't even have Target in Oxford. There's no Target here. So anyway, I had to drive up to Memphis, and that's an hour and a half away. I did a shopping trip, drove back home. I mean, it's been a day, and now it's 9:45 p.m., and I've got to get up tomorrow at 5:30. So it's just there's a lot. It's rough.
Did you at least get some barbecue?
I didn't. No, I didn't have time. I just went, I shopped, I immediately came back because I had to be back to record and do all kinds of just things.
Did you take the girls with you?
Yes, they came with me and they played on their tablets on the way up there. And they were very excited that we were going to another state to go shopping. And yeah.
It is very non-California.
Yeah. A lot of things to get used to out here.
Yeah. The dogs go with you?
No, the poor dogs. Oh my gosh. Those poor angels.
You should have packed the dogs, the cats, the girls, yeah, Frank.
No, I know. Everybody.
The whole crew.
Everybody goes to Costco.
Pick up some random person.
You know what that happens here though, is like when you tell somebody here, like, oh, I'm going to Costco, like, can I go with you? Because it's an excursion. I kept this trip secret.
It's like, I don't know, can you?
Are you capable? No, but I do. I've brought back like paper towels and Keurig pods and all kinds of stuff for people, like these special requests of, you know, just things that you can't really get around here. Or like,
so you're like the Wells Fargo wagon.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah.
They should sing the song.
I'm for like you. The mail order catalog.
Are you like Montgomery Ward?
I'm like Montgomery Ward. Yeah, exactly. And you know what's funny is there's still a Sears here. Anyway.
That's not. Huh. Mm. It's surprising, but it's not surprising. I mean, it's interesting too, because this kind of rural thing, it is salient to our conversation today. I mean, it's funny because I know sometimes it seems like we're just rambling. We are most of the time. But there is this rural urban thing that I think we'll get to. But let's kind of get down to Prohibition. Let's kind of set our start date. So I think the reason we wanted to do it this month is Prohibition started, went into effect January 17th, 1920. Right?
Yes. And they had a big party the night before it went into effect, right? Like the party to end all parties to try to get rid of all the alcohol, and had been doing so for a couple weeks leading up to it, stockpiling and partying and having a really great time. And I often think about that, you know, because I know it's not right to look back on it nostalgically, but like, if you do think about a time to be alive, like, wouldn't that have been sort of that fun? Night before. Like, yeah, to just have like the big giant, like, all right, let's just get rid of all the alcohol and we'll all get alcohol poisoning, but I mean, or something. I don't know.
So, yeah. So January 16th, 1920, there were these big parties. But the odd thing is there were big parties July 1st, 1919 as well, because of the Wartime Prohibition Act, this thing that went into effect right at the end of the war, June 1919. And it was meant to conserve grain because grain had kind of wartime uses. But then the war ends up ending 6 months later, right? Not even 6 months later. Right. July 1st, 1919, nickname is the Thirsty First.
The Thirsty First. It's like an excuse to party, and we still do that. And I love that overlap.
Well, yeah. But it's funny that they got one on June 30th, and they got another one on the following year they got one on January 16th.
Yeah, they get a party.
Yeah.
To end alcohol. Which doesn't end.
But I mean, this thing, so it's the, right, so it's the 18th Amendment, and I think it's useful to kind of read Section 1, which is the real gist of it, because I think some people misunderstand what it prohibits and what it doesn't prohibit. So it says, after 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within, the importation thereof into, or the exportation thereof from the United States and all territories subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes, is hereby prohibited. So notice it does not ban the consumption of alcohol, nor does it ban the personal possession.
Yeah, manufacture, sale, transportation.
So if I own a keg of whiskey at home and I don't move it anywhere and I don't sell it and I'm not making it, I am technically not in violation of this amendment.
Right. If you're making moonshine in your bathtub, technically you're not in violation yet. So there's a lot of loopholes that are laid out as a result of this rather ambiguous language, but also almost purposefully loopholed, I would say, because there comes all sorts of different ways that people begin to make liquor available. Because the thing is like, it doesn't ever go away, right? They have these big parties pretending like it's going away, but it never goes anywhere. And as a matter of fact, I think we'll argue throughout this, maybe not, but for me, I'll argue is like, I think people started drinking more.
I think alcohol consumption goes up. I think it dips initially, but then I think it goes up because and it's interesting too, because there are a couple of historians who've argued that's not really what happens. I don't think so. I disagree. I mean, I don't know. I mean, so we've got Prohibition, right? We've got the 18th Amendment, but I think more important is the Volstead Act.
Right. So that's to put it into place and to try to enforce it. Is that?
Yeah. So this is, the purpose of the act were to prohibit intoxicating beverages, to regulate manufacture, production, use, and sale of high proof spirits, and to ensure an ample supply of alcohol and promote its use in scientific research. But I mean, what's interesting is people who supported the 18th Amendment, most people assumed wine and beer would not be on the chopping block.
And it is. Yeah, they are. And I think that, so the one thing with the Volstead Act, though, is that it's vetoed by the president. Uh-huh. So President Wilson says, yeah, you know, like vetoes it. It's like, we're not, the Volstead Act goes into effect to make the law enforceable. Right. And so that is the important, that's sort of the thing that's necessary to do in order to even, in order to enforce prohibition. But then the president is not in favor of this and vetoes it. But then Congress overrides that veto to pass the law to strengthen and bolster the Volstead Act. And I find that tension interesting politically, because how is Congress so behind this? And how do you get Congress behind it? I mean, we can talk about all the things that lead up to that, of course. But then the president is like, no, we're not doing this. And they're like, no, yes, we are. It's interesting.
Don't you think a lot of this, though, is that Congress hates Wilson by this point?
Well, yes, Congress hates Wilson. But, I mean, do you hate the president that much to ban alcohol?
I don't know. I mean, I think don't you think it factors into it even a little bit, maybe?
Potentially, just that political animosity. And then especially also knowing that the elite people aren't actually going to be infected, or the Volstead Act is not going to be enforced upon elite people. I think that there's that understanding of it as well. It's like, well, this actually isn't going to impact us.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They, you know, there's no... It's like many other laws that have been designed to regulate social things. Mm-hmm. If you're wealthy enough, you can circumvent them.
Sure. And you not just can circumvent them, but you're not even worried about if you are caught, because it's not going to be enforced to you. Because really, at the end of the day, it was never enforced very well at all for anybody. Right. There was just not the infrastructure available to enforce prohibition.
Well, they start off with something like 1,500 agents
for the entire country
nationwide.
Yeah.
Right.
For the entire country. How stupid.
And it's interesting too. I mean, it's interesting to think that today Americans think of our border with Mexico as this security risk border that has to be constantly policed. 1920s, it's Canada. It's this long northern border that's just easy to bring stuff over.
Well, and I was just having this conversation with a colleague the other day about women's clubs along the border and about border security and control and like what happens with that and when that becomes bolstered. And it's very much related to prohibition and the Volstead Act. And we often think about the border, and most certainly right now, we think of the border as a space where we are trying to keep Mexican people out of the United States. During Prohibition, it's the exact opposite. You have people trying to keep Americans out of Mexico who were trying to go down and drink. And it's these women's clubs who are so involved in policing, wanting the border policed to keep their husbands from going across the border and getting drunk. And I think that's so interesting, because we think of it as like, oh, well, we've always needed to keep people out of this country. It's like, no, we were trying to keep people in this country. The regulations a lot of times during the 19 teens, even when things started getting a little more, you know, like there was a lot more regulation over the consumption of alcohol because of these, the strengthening of these temperance unions, but that people wanted border security in order to police their own husbands. Women wanted border security. And I think that that's like, I don't think that's something we talk about often enough.
Right. Well, here's, I mean, so it's interesting because I think you've brought up a couple of the issues. First of all, women and their relationship with prohibition. So the 18th Amendment passes, which allows prohibition. The 19th Amendment passes, which gives women the right to vote. And it's in that order.
Right. So we touched on that a couple of episodes back to kind of dispel that notion that it's women getting the right to vote that passes prohibition.
However, there is something going on, right? There's this, so there's an argument to be made that women are politically emboldened by their participation in getting prohibition enacted, and it allows them to kind of finally make suffrage happen.
Is this what you're saying to try to inflame me?
No, I don't know whether I agree with this interpretation. Well, this is an interpretation.
I don't agree with that interpretation. I think that women, the idea that women weren't politically active until voting passed, and the idea that women weren't politically active until prohibition passed, I think is just a really troubling notion to begin with, because women are really politically active.
Well, I'm not saying women weren't politically active. What I'm saying is, getting this national amendment to enact prohibition is kind of propels them forward to finally demanding full suffrage.
Well, but they had been demanding that for years under the leadership of a more radical feminist movement under the leadership of Alice Paul and Lucy Burns in the 19 teens during that progressive era. And I don't want to get into the definition of what is progressive, but let's say from like 1910 all the way up until the passage of the 19th Amendment, women are radically pushing for suffrage, but women are just becoming more politically radical. So I think that the two things happen in tandem, but I wouldn't say that the passage of prohibition is what propels them into a radical demand of voting inclusivity or rights or suffrage, right? I think that that had been happening for many years prior.
Does it help?
Well, I think that there's different factions at play, though, too. I mean, I don't know if the same women who are so ardently temperance movement women are the same women who are ardent feminist suffragettes. There's definitely overlap in a Venn diagram, but I think that they're also, you have to consider them as two different causes, because temperance unions emerge in the 1830s. So close to 100 years prior to prohibition even taking effect. And I'm not sure that they're the same people who are working on these things. And maybe that can be up for debate.
Well, so I got some data. You know me, I love to go get data.
Go for it.
What state is the first state to ratify the 18th Amendment? This should be easy for you.
Well,
right now.
Right now for me, Mississippi.
Mississippi. Yeah. So Mississippi. I mean, let me give you a list of the first 10 states that ratify prohibition. Mississippi, Virginia, Kentucky, North Dakota, which kind of sticks out as this oddball in the list. South Carolina, Maryland, Montana, again, kind of like, wait, what? Texas, Delaware, South Dakota. So you've got a body of southern states in there. Now, here's the interesting thing. Notice the order there for the states that are really on board prohibition. And you get in the next 10, you also get a lot of other southern states, including Georgia, Louisiana, Florida. 19th Amendment. So this is women's suffrage. What's the last state to ratify women's suffrage?
Probably Mississippi. Now,
Mississippi, yeah. In 1984.
Oh, gosh.
So here are the last states that ratified ratified the 19th Amendment. Mississippi, 1984. North Carolina, 1971. Louisiana, 1970. Georgia, 1970. South Carolina, 1969. Florida, 1969. Alabama, 1953. Virginia, 1952.
So that supports my argument that it's not right, the same people who are lobbying.
I think for prohibition, initially, there may have been a little unity, but I think it starts to fracture. I don't know. I mean, that's interesting data, right? I mean, it's almost flipping. And if you like look at it on a map, you see it. It's like the states that reject prohibition are the states that pass women's suffrage pretty early. And the states that like really embrace prohibition really do not embrace the idea of women's suffrage. However, prohibition by March 9th, 1922, so New Jersey's really late. New Jersey ratifies it late and Rhode Island doesn't. They reject it. Every other state before its enactment ratifies prohibition. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is. But I think I like complicating the narrative of feminism and about women's mm-hmm. political involvement, because it's not just one single strain. It's not, oh, all women want this one thing or all women want that one thing. I mean, this shows the fractures amongst women themselves. And I mean, a lot of this is going to be regional, educational, religious. There are so many cultural factors that are going to break down these lines of communication amongst women themselves. It's not going to create a unanimous decision about what the most important political agenda is, right? And so mm-hmm. I think that that's kind of neat, because oftentimes when we talk about women's suffrage or the women's movement or the progressive era, there's kind of this baseline scratch the surface understanding of like, well, all women did this or that. It's like, well, no, I mean, and that's the case at every moment in history. Not one group is homogeneously in agreement about something. And so I love those data that you pulled to show that like it's right. The exact opposite of that. And come Mississippi, come on. Every time.
Well, I mean, it's curious, right? It's like it makes you start to think, is like, is prohibition antithetical to women's suffrage?
This is a paper. This is an article. This isn't just a podcast. We've got to go somewhere with this.
So, I mean, this is my big beef with that Ken Burns Prohibition series.
You know, I didn't watch kind of that, sets, I have to admit.
It's interesting. It's interesting, but I think one of my biggest beefs is he initially sets out and kind of says, I'm going to kind of dispel this idea that women are really driving prohibition. And then for three episodes, it's women driving prohibition. And there's something there, right? I think there's something there that we assume is happening and it doesn't seem to be happening, but there's something else happening. I mean, why would a state quickly support prohibition but be the last one to get on board with suffrage? What is going on there?
Like I said, it's regional and it's educational, because you have to think about mm-hmm. who's driving the suffrage movement. Where do those women live? What is their educational level? And what is their religious affiliation? And you'll find that it's going to be the exact opposite of women in Mississippi.
I wonder with Mississippi, with prohibition.
I think it's definitely worth looking into more.
I think it has to do with race in Mississippi as well.
Yes. Yeah, always going to be layered on to anything.
Right, and I wonder if it's something like wealthy or kind of influential families feel insulated, like you said before, from this prohibition. Like, they're going to be able to get around it. Mm-hmm. It's not really going
to
affect them.
They want
to.
Yes.
Right, but it's actually meant to keep poor people and Black Mississippians from being able to get alcohol.
Being able to access alcohol. Yeah. That, I mean, I think that that's definitely part of it. And, you know, when I was doing research for this and when I was, you know, thinking about talking points and stuff, I mean, I have so many things written down about the history of the temperance movement and all that. And I think all that's important, but like, this is actually getting to some, in a direction that I didn't think that we could take here. But I mean, this isn't a kind of an argument to be made. And I really like considering it in this way, where it's not just about whether women were or were not involved, because it's not a black and white situation. And I think oftentimes people are reactionary to that. It's like, well, it's not women's fault. And I've been reactionary in that way before. It's not women's fault that prohibition passed, because women couldn't even vote at the time, right? But it's not that simple, because women's groups and women were so politically active for close to 100 years in this realm. And why are people so quick to be defensive of women? It's like, different women can have different views on what they think is moral or immoral or right or wrong for society. Making me think differently.
So I'm going to, on our site, I'm going to post a link to this image. It's a editorial cartoon created in late 1919, early 1920. And it says, the defender of the 18th Amendment. And it's got a woman's fist crashing up through the ground and like throwing all these revelers with like beer and wine and stuff around. And across her, it says KKK. And on her top of her fist is a little KKK.
Oh, good night.
Rope. See?
And the reemergence of the Klan during this era, 1919, 1920. Uh-huh. I mean, and the participation, overlap and participation of the WCTU and like all these things. I mean, like Women's Christian Temperance Union is what that stands for.
Right.
Whoa.
I know, right? I mean, I'm doing the research to get ready for tonight's episode, and I was looking and I was like, this is weird. Like, one thing I know we want to talk about is the racial and ethnic nature of prohibition, because I think this is one thing that gets lost on the public a lot, is the reason Wilson vetoes the Volstead Act is it goes too far. It's not supposed to touch beer and wine. It's supposed to hit hard liquor, right? Which is a class bound and an ethnic thing.
Yes. That's exactly it. It's the type of alcohol and who's drinking what types of alcohol. And it's going to target particular ethnic groups. The Irish, the Italians, the Germans.
Yeah.
And that's who they're wanting to target. And I think that we glorify this era for the rise in like bootlegging and gangsterism and the rise of the mafia and all this stuff. And we have all these movies and shows. And I think that we're nostalgic for that mafia kind of era and the Al Capone stuff. But whoa, this is a horrible, horrible result of prohibition, is the rise of organized crime. The violence and the...
But there are a couple of historians who argue that it doesn't happen that way. I don't see how they can make that argument. And I tried to read their papers and find kind of a valid thing. I disagree. It just...
Well, there's no need to be apologetic about it. It just does happen. And and we watch it happen right now. So something that I was finding interesting in my reflections on this era and then thinking of right now, 100 years later, is that our perception of back then is kind of nostalgic and all that. But like, people weren't thinking it was cute that the mafia was emerging at this time, right? They were mad. They were felt nationalistic, racist towards Italians, right? Toward, you know, all these different crime syndicates that are rising up. Right now, we think it's cute that the Italian mafia ran the streets or whatever. And we have all these television shows and movies and stuff to glorify that. But I can't help but think of the 21st century context of that, of like, drugs are illegal. Well, who traffics drugs, or what is the perception of who traffics drugs? Right. And I'm thinking about the article that I just read today about the tunnel that was discovered in San Diego that went from Tijuana into San Diego that was over 4,000 feet of sophisticated railway systems, underground rail systems for the transportation of drugs, and elevators in shafts that went underground underneath the Mexican-American border to traffic drugs. And
well, and who's the criminal?
Well,
in the public's perception, who's the criminal in that situation? It's the drug traffickers, it's the people that do it. And it's not the people consuming the
drugs. It's not the people consuming. It's the people trafficking. There's no discussion of demand. There's only discussion of sale. And that, to me, is the overlap between the 1920s and right now, is that in this context today, we glorify and feel, like, oh, that era, oh, is so cool or something. And we have like a style related to it. But like in that moment, people were not having it. I mean, the rise in the FBI, right? Like, or the Elliot Ness versus Al Capone kind of stuff. And like, I mean, there's a lot layered there because a lot of the public liked Al Capone too. But there was a major tension between the growing body of the government and law enforcement and enforcement in general. There was a tension between that and the general public. There were class, racial, ethnic, religious tensions that rose as a result. I think there were a lot of unintended consequences to prohibition.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. And I want to return to something you said a moment ago, because I think it's worth repeating. Like, our obsession with the 1920s, it's interesting. It's a little disturbing because people tend to forget the bad stuff that happens in the 20s. But they never, so people read The Great Gatsby and they never think of Jay Gatsby and Daisy Buchanan as villains or criminals. They kind of admire their lives, right? Unless they read the entire novel, and then maybe their view changes a little bit.
Well, I think we're meant to do that. I think that's why it's assigned reading. Is like, it's almost meant to have a nostalgic and
they love it.
Romanticized view, okay, right?
It, right?
Yeah.
Right. They're okay with it. And you see all these things that are set in the 20s and flappers and all of this stuff. And I mean, these people are breaking the law.
Yeah. Breaking the law.
So this new word gets invented. Right. They're breaking the law. So this new word gets invented. And I wanted to bring this up because I love this. so there's a contest in 1923. Del Cavera King, what a name. He's this banker. He loves prohibition. He does this nationwide competition to come up with a new word for people who are lawless drinkers. And it's a $200 prize in gold.
What?
Yeah, $200 prize in gold.
I love it.
$200 prize in gold for the winner. And it turns out he gets over 25,000 entries. But two people, Henry Irving Dale and Kate L. Butler, both submit the same word. And it's a portmanteau, so it's two words combined. Scofflaw.
Ooh. Scofflaw. I didn't know that. I didn't know that was a result of a contest.
Yeah. I mean, and we know when it happens. You can look in the New York Times. It's got March 22nd, 1964 issue of the New York Times has the obituary for Del Cavera King.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing is prohibitionist contest led to coining of scofflaw.
Nice.
So that's what
he kind of Seinfeld
went
too.
Yeah. There's an episode of Seinfeld called scofflaw.
Sorry.
But I mean,
I always think of that when I hear the scofflaw.
So here's the thing. 1923, there are at least some people who do not like the idea that Americans are willing to break the law to drink.
Yeah, but that I think that percentage of people has always been like the tail wagging the dog kind of a thing. Because, yeah, there are some people who are ardent prohibitionists. But most, there isn't a ton of public support for prohibition. It's just like the people who were like the squeakiest wheels, I think, eventually got the grease after 100 years of pushing so, so hard. And it's like religiously motivated and class motivated. And so much of it is a reaction to mass immigration. And, but I don't think that the general public, I don't think that they did support it. But then, those people who were so against it, they're coining the terms like scofflaw and stuff. And they're just like the small, I would say the small percentage of killjoys.
All right. So picking back up, we were talking about whether or not most Americans supported prohibition after it was enacted.
And I would say no.
It certainly seems that way, right? I mean, there's no clear way for us to figure this out, really. Apart from the fact that the number of Americans who still seem to be consuming alcohol by 1923 seems pretty substantial.
There's a substantial number of people who are still consuming, but I would say one of the biggest pieces of evidence to point to the fact that people were not supportive of this is the massive economic impact that prohibition had. Restaurants closed, breweries, distilleries, bars, all of this led to tens of thousands of jobs. And one of the biggest things is tax revenue plummeted because there was historically excise taxes on liquor. And a lot of states depended so heavily on that tax that they were losing a lot of money.
The Whiskey Rebellion, one of our first episodes, right? It comes back to that.
Yeah. And a lot of states, so New York, for example, 75% of the state's revenue was derived from liquor taxes. So if you could just think about the insane economic impact that this has, not only on the loss of jobs, the closing of restaurants and all this, but just the fact that because you're technically not allowed to sell liquor. And this doesn't mean that it's not being sold. It's just being under the table and the government's not reaping any of the benefits of it anymore. And this is my argument about drugs, right? If like drugs were taxed, man, we'd be making all kinds of money. But and then in addition to that, prohibition ends up costing the federal government billions of dollars, right? In lost tax revenue, but then the cost to enforce it. So if you're talking lost revenue in the billions of dollars in the 1920s, that is excessive amount of money. But then you're talking in the hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of trying to enforce prohibition. This is a massive loss. I can't imagine that anyone thought that this was a good idea for a very long time.
Well, so California, a lot of people thought, once prohibition started, once the Volstead Act banned wine, except for religious reasons, California would really suffer, right? The California kind of wine growing region like Napa, Sonoma. And they actually saw an increase. First of all these people sign up for religious exemptions, right? So all these people are kind of saying,
I love that loophole.
It's like, I'm religious. Evidently, the number of people who were Jewish increased tenfold in Brooklyn after Prohibition.
Because churches or religious places could have wine for religious purposes.
And you could have it at home, Sabbath on Friday night.
Massive increase in church membership, yes. And another loophole was the pharmacist.
Medicinal whiskey cracks me up.
So you could, pharmacists could dispense whiskey by prescription. And so the number of registered pharmacists tripled in New York State during the Prohibition era. And many bootlegging storefronts were pharmacies because, the pharmacist can dispense liquor. And so everyone's like, well, I'm a pharmacist now. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, what's not hilarious about it, though, again, is I can't help but think of the 21st century context and think of the opioid crisis. Who's dispensing this heroin to everybody? It's doctors and pharmacists. And like, that's really scary to think about in that context, that, you know, it's okay to prescribe drugs that are killing people, you know? I mean, to say it's prescription or whatever. I mean, I'm not like a prohibitionist or something, but like that does, because that's such a salient political issue at the moment, that does weigh a little heavier on me when you think about, like, okay, it is kind of funny that everyone says that they're a pharmacist to prescribe whiskey, but then you do think about our current issue, and it's a little more sensitive, I think.
Well, so let's get back to just dollars and cents. $11 billion federal debt.
That's crazy.
Because in 1920s. Because of prohibition. This was lost revenue that they'd counted on that they're losing. And this organized crime thing, I love like looking at the intersection between organized crime and how Al Capone is kind of Italian American and kind of it's constantly reinforced in the public's mind even today. But you get other people who were really opposed to prohibition and their voice gets cut out. German Americans.
Yes.
So prior to World War I, they really opposed prohibition for a number of reasons. And during the war, they are no longer kind of really permitted to participate in public discourse. And by the end of the war, their voices just aren't taken into account. And I think one of the reasons the Volstead Act increases to include wine and beer is they want to target Southern Europeans and German Americans.
Well, certainly, because it's so cultural, right? Beer drinking and wine drinking, that's going to target specific groups of people, no doubt about it. And then the beer drinking too for the Irish immigrants, it hits at a cultural norm. And it's white middle class, very conservative Christian people where it's not necessarily impacting them. Or in another vein, it's not infecting them because of their class status, perhaps. But also, like, a lot of these really religious conservative people are just like, we're not the degenerates who are out drinking all the time. It's those immigrants. And by banning things that are so a part of culture, right? German culture, Irish culture, Italian culture. It's like that is a direct hit. It's a direct hit to them. But those religious loopholes, interesting. Do you know that those religious loopholes still kind of play a role in Pennsylvania in some way?
Pennsylvania has some of the weirdest. Like the stores. It was when I was doing research there, I think I wanted to get like a beer or something to drink at the place I was renting while I was doing research. And I just wanted to pick a six pack of beer up just to have, cause I was getting home so late from the archives and stuff. And I went to the grocery store and was very confused. Mm-hmm. And then one of the clerks says, oh no, you got to go to a,
state run,
but he called it something. There was a specific name he called it. And I was like, what is that? And he was like, it's where you get beer. And I was like, okay, like what, are there different ones? And he was like, nope, they're all the state. And I was like,
yeah, they're all state run.
I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of odd.
Yeah. And then there's different ones for liquor stores. Because they can't be sold in the same place.
They can't sell beer and wine in the same place they sell liquor.
Exactly. Ugh. And so I lived there for a few years, and you have to go to a wine store or to a beer store, and it's, you know, like a market, and they're sold separately, and the state runs them, and the liquor laws are just kind of nuts when you think about it. And we were so excited where we lived in State College, Pennsylvania, which is where Penn State is. There was a Wegmans grocery store there, and right as we were leaving, Wegmans finally got a license to be able to sell beer and wine. And everyone was so jazzed about it. But, you know, you have to go to these state-run stores, and you also, you're not allowed to have alcohol shipped to the state. So say you have like a relative that wants to send you a bottle of wine or something, you're technically not allowed to do that. But those religious loopholes still hold true. So I had some colleagues at Penn State who used to have a particular wine that they really liked shipped to a local church that they were friends with the people at the church, and the wine would get shipped to the church, and then they would go pick up the wine from the church because of this like crazy leftover prohibition law that was still impacting people in like 2016, right? So Pennsylvania is so crazy, but then Pennsylvania is actually one of the wettest states, so to speak, right? When during the prohibition era, like there's more alcohol flowing through Pennsylvania illegally during prohibition than any other state.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at its position.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So, Kansas is the first state of the modern prohibition era. Maine does a prohibition thing, but Kansas has prohibition in its state constitution starting in 1880s, I think. Kansas and Texas, still two states where the majority of counties are dry counties today.
Yes, there are still places that are dry. I mean, throughout the United States, there are places that are still, I mean, and obviously Utah is one of the biggest ones where there's just places where you can't get alcohol. And even in Mississippi, there are weird, like, you can't buy it on this day. You can't buy it after
this time. Oh, the blue laws. Yeah, the blue laws.
Yeah, those are still, like, you can't buy alcohol on Sundays. What?
I love when Trader Joe's puts the little rope up in places where they have those laws.
Little rope. Well, like, and that they're not allowed to ring it up. I mean, it's not even like the workers there are trying to be weird. It's just like the ABC laws will not allow them, or the state liquor and alcohol laws will not allow them, and they'll lose their license. They'll lose their ability to even operate. And
but here's, I mean, I think the thing is the lesson, like, doesn't prohibition, doesn't the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act kind of provide a lesson that if you try to do this social control over people and ban something, it actually makes it more attractive to some people who maybe would not have been interested in this very much before?
Obviously not. That's not a lesson we've learned. Because no, but look at what we've done with marijuana. My goodness.
But, well, yeah.
And I mean, drugs in general, I guess. But like, yeah, trying to exert social control rarely works. And then it ends up costing a lot of money. And it ends up with all these unintended consequences. And no, we didn't learn the lesson because we continually do it with all sorts of things. It's not just alcohol and drugs. I mean, we've regulated sex historically, and we can have a podcast about that. I mean, sodomy was illegal until 2003, right? I mean, like, there are all sorts of things that we try to like regulate socially, and it just doesn't go well. And I think it's interesting you say it's more appealing to people.
I think it is. I think that's, you get all these people that are, in the show notes, I'll put a link to it. There's a great book called Slumming It.
Oh, yeah.
That's Chad Heap, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And he talks about kind of this thing. And it was something kind of middle class and kind of upper class, particularly younger people, but not necessarily, would do. And they would kind of go to these kind of more tawdry sections of their cities. In New York, it was to go down to the Bowery, or later it became to go up to Harlem, right? Mm-hmm. And you would go to these places that you weren't really, that you didn't feel entirely safe in, but that you could also see kind of forbidden things going on. And prohibition kind of does that. It really encourages that. At the same time, some people have argued that creates the foundation for the civil rights movement. Again, an argument I don't really agree with. Because I don't see the people that are participating in slumming it like driving civil rights initiatives. Like,
right, and we're talking a generation at least.
And we're talking 40 years difference, right?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, what if women in prohibition, I want to get back to this because I want to ask, like, so an argument's made that after abolition, social reformers need something to get behind. And the two things they get behind are temperance and suffrage.
There are a lot of things they get behind. Those are two of them.
The argument would be that those are the two kind of most widely engaged in.
Well, if you look, though, at like white slavery, right?
Yeah.
Women are heavily involved. That's prostitution. Women's mm-hmm. groups. I mean, there's a lot of literature out there about like that is one of the crusades of women. And then another point, too, is women get really involved in the regulation of the workplace during the Progressive Era, too. I mean, I think there are a lot of causes that women get behind. I think, prohibition is salient, but there are a lot of things.
Don't you think prohibition kind of overlaps with a lot of these other things? So,
yeah.
Kind of regulating, kind of improving conditions for working poor in urban spaces.
Yeah.
Prohibition's definitely part of that.
Improving the social sphere.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's hygiene campaigns, Americanization campaigns, labor disputes, hourly wage disputes, hours, child labor, all at prostitution. All of these things are causes that women get behind because women are so politically active in the late 19th and early 20th century. I mean, just no right to vote yet, but incredibly influential politically. And I think you're right. I think that there is an overlap with prohibition and oftentimes in many of these cases, but I mean, I would just make the argument that women are involved in a lot of stuff. And I don't think that there's two that are more important than others, I guess.
Well, do you think prohibition gets seen as a panacea? If we actually remove this, we might fix a lot of these other problems in the process.
Maybe, but again, if we're looking at those data, those really interesting data that you shared, I don't think that the same women were involved in the same crusades. I think that there were different demographics of women. Women are politically motivated, but I think that there are different motivations based on region, class, religion. I think, again, women had a lot of different causes, but I'm not positive that they always overlapped with one another. So I would say with like the panacea argument, that's interesting to think about during this era when you like Margaret Sanger, like trying to like distribute birth control in mass, right? Like trying to be like, well, we need to like decrease the population. The immigrants are reproducing too much. They're drinking, they're reproducing, they're, you know, I think that there's an overlap there.
Yeah. And I think that's, I'm glad you brought Margaret Sanger up because I love when, I don't valorize anybody till they're dead and we know everything about them because people are complicated and like people are like, Margaret Sanger was so great. And it was like, yeah, I guess pay attention to some of the things she says, which is really, messed up. She's a eugenicist.
Yes, she is.
Right.
Was. Yes.
And it's like, yeah, it's great she got birth control out there, but the reason she wanted it
was to stop certain people from reproducing.
And
that's the argument that a lot of women have today who may be more, you know, lean liberal or something, but the arguments against Planned Parenthood is like, well, it's a eugenics experiment. It's another dabbling in eugenics. And that's, again, a whole nother topic, but it has roots in that Margaret Sangerness of like, we need to control population. We need to control the types of people who are reproducing. We need to make birth control available to certain populations to make sure that they're not having too many kids. And that changes who they're trying to limit from having kids changes depending on the era. Because, I mean, I think Margaret Sanger was just like a general eugenicist, but I mean, they were talking about like Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants, and then, of course, Black Americans fell into the categories of people trying to stop, people having larger families and things like that. But those populations change. And I would argue that in the 21st century, those efforts are targeted towards Latino communities and people of, you know, maybe Hispanic or Mexican, South American descent. I think that those communities are the ones that are targeted the most now. And Black Americans also fall into the category. But nobody's saying like, oh, the Irish are having too many babies now. But Margaret Sanger was. But those efforts, I mean, I think can be very much traced back and again overlap with the prohibition stuff, because I think you make a good point that like there's an idea that there's like drains on society, right? That there's like social ills, and definitely one of the social ills is the consumption of alcohol. And so you do have an overlap oftentimes. But again, I caution that based on those data you shared, I don't think that there's always an overlap of the women's, I said crusades a bunch using the same word, but the women's causes basically. I'm not positive that the same women are involved in the same causes.
Well, I mean, this is the argument for why ERA fails.
So we have to have an episode about the ERA, right?
Definitely. I mean, you have these coalitions that get something. So suffrage is a result of a coalition. And then that coalition kind of evaporates. I mean, I wonder how successful that coalition really is. But I kind of want to take it back to kind of something really interesting, particularly in Southern California. So there's this place called the Mexicali Beer Hall that existed in Tijuana. It opens in the early 1920s, closes in 1933, which is when Prohibition ends in the United States. It's the longest bar in the world. It's a 200-foot bar inside this building, and it occupies an entire city block in Tijuana. And it becomes a really popular place for like Hollywood, Hollywood elites, film stars, things like that, and wealthy people in Southern California to go to drink. It's very sociable. So, I mean, it's very indicative of this fact that if you have enough money, prohibition doesn't hurt you at all.
So you're saying like you can always avoid it by going different places? Because I don't think you have to have money to go to Tijuana, do you? It's mostly about location, and is it accessible?
It's location, but I think it's in the 1920s when people are growing here, it is very much kind of an elite hangout. It's not just, you know,
and it's going to have something to do with leisure also, like right, the ability right, and to leisure. Go. Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's so prohibition doesn't really hurt the wealthy and the powerful. Who it hurts are people who are like employed at the Budweiser brewery in St. Louis. The little old man who owns the corner bar that now
restaurants
is,
and yeah. Yeah.
You know, these are the people that are really going to get hurt, by this. I'm not sure the people who push for prohibition really cared.
Yeah, I don't think that they thought too much into it. And I think they thought, well, they're degenerates. If you own a bar, you're a degenerate.
Yeah.
So we're doing you a favor.
I mean, now, you're not leaving this voluntarily. We're going to make it impossible if you continue in this.
Because we are the, you know, keepers of morality. We'll tell you what's right or wrong to do. Don't worry.
So prohibition ends 1933.
Okay. Question.
Oh,
does prohibition contribute to the depression?
$11 billion.
$11 billion. Impactful. Yeah.
$11 billion debt at the end of the 1920s, the federal government's in because of lost revenues for alcohol.
So the stock market crashes in 1929. I'm not sure has there been work done on this, but it would seem like, yeah, I mean, it would seem like that's pretty direct correlation, but.
I mean, the 1920s are so complicated because consumer culture is really kind of rising. You have a number of Americans who do, I wouldn't say their disposable income goes up too much, but they do have a little bit of income and they're kind of being told invest it. And here's the thing. The stock market's risky, right?
Yeah, it is.
What if you're already taking your significant other out and going to speakeasies a couple of nights a week? You're already engaging in risky behavior.
That's true. That's true. Risky business.
Well, that's the thing is, like, does it make people less risk averse? Does being a scofflaw lead to think, and this is like just half-assed, I'm sure. And I'm sure somebody who's out there who's like a scholar of this is listening to it, like, what an idiotic statement.
Shut up, Hillary and Jeff.
But I just wonder, it's like, if you're already doing that risk adverse behavior, does it make you more open to other risk adverse behaviors?
That's an interesting question to pose, I think. But I mean, it also, we have to caution ourselves not to try to psychoanalyze people.
I love psychoanalyzing people.
Oh, sure. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how can we really measure that? We can't. I mean, it's an interesting thing to think about. Are you drinking while you're doing the prohibition podcast?
I am drinking water. I'm pretending I'm in the Senate.
Okay.
And I can drink milk or water.
Okay.
Did you know that?
I would go with chocolate milk.
Did you? No. He had Mitt Romney had to sneak his chocolate milk in.
He drinks chocolate milk. There's caffeine in it.
Maybe get some special chocolate milk that doesn't have caffeine.
He better. I'm going to revoke his Mormonhood.
Evidently the only two beverages you're allowed to drink in the Senate when you're in the Senate chamber is milk and water.
That's really weird. That's just really freaking weird. I mean,
but we know during Prohibition, people are going, I mean, during Harrison's administration, they were serving alcohol in the White House.
Sure.
I mean,
not going to stop drinking.
No, that's the thing is.
I mean, they don't. That never stops. The flow of alcohol never stops.
Right. I mean, the question is, does it increase? And it certainly seems like it does.
Well, so another one of the unintended consequences that's important is like the flow of alcohol never stops. The enforcement of it, though, does go into effect. Even as half-assed as it goes into effect, it still does go into effect. This completely clogs up the court system. The courts become years behind in trying cases.
Well, and I mean,
the jails are overflowing. The legal system's locked up. Mm-hmm. There's backlogs of cases. And the law that was like meant to encourage temperance, right? It ends up encouraging drinking to excess. It ends up clogging up the court systems. And it was interesting doing some research for this to figure out that this is the era where we very first see the rise of the plea bargain, because this was the first time it's ever widely used in the American court system to just try to get people out of jail, because it's just so backlogged. And it's important to think about. It's just like people never stop drinking, but people do start getting in trouble for it. And it's inconsistent as to who's getting in trouble, why, when, where. But what we do know is that the regulation of the sale, distribution, and brewing of liquor, distilling of liquor, is unregulated at this point. People are dying because they're drinking tainted alcohol because people don't stop drinking. And so to me, it's like all of these unintended consequences of this asinine law, the repercussions of it are felt to this day. I mean, the plea bargain thing, that's really interesting.
Well, I would say you combine this along with when we talked about the Red Summer and the Red Scare.
Yeah.
In 1919, I mean, there's this 2-year window, 1919, 1920, where I think these things happen that lead to the rise of this substantially increased state police apparatus.
Yes.
And by state, I mean nation level state. I don't mean individual states. I mean, the federal government has this increased police presence nationally because of this.
Yes. Yeah. That's such an interesting point, because you really do see the growth and the state power structure becoming robust.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends up just as a domino effect of disaster, where we are in a full-blown crisis right now with mass incarceration. And mm-hmm. the fact that you see for the very first time the American criminal court systems getting so clogged up as a result of prohibition, I mean, again, the reverberation here is, it's, I don't like, I mean, sometimes I like laugh at things that happen historically, and I guess I shouldn't do that because like it really does cause a current issue. Or it's part of it,
well,
right?
I think what it is I think one of the reasons they're so loath to prosecute people or to process them.
They don't have the ability.
They don't have the ability, but I also think it's a lot of white middle-class people. And they don't want to do that.
They wouldn't be holding them. I mean, because they are still holding them for like, there are people who are being held for like a year or two. Right, Harvey? Are you still there?
I'll have to edit this out. Rick came in, and of course, Harvey went crazy.
Yeah. But
my point is, I think unlike the war on drugs, and I think this is the thing, is you can make clear connections between prohibition and the war on drugs and look at how they change. Prohibition, I think, is racialized. The problem is they didn't think it was going to be racialized, whereas the war on drugs, I think, is racialized intentionally, and everybody participating in it kind of knew it was.
Yeah.
And I think it's why prohibition ends after 13 years, whereas the war on drugs still kind of continues.
Oh, it's very much in full swing, I would say. Mm-hmm. And okay, that's, yeah.
But I think it's because it was not.
There's a difference, though. I think we're like a lot of like our war on drugs stuff, right? Like most of the drugs that we're having a war on have never been legal in the first place. The weirdness with the alcohol is like drinking alcohol is so part of American culture. And then to all of a sudden be like, you can't drink alcohol anymore. I mean, it would be like if there was a ban on soda.
I'm glad you bring up soda. I assumed soda consumption rose during prohibition.
Did it not?
Doesn't look like it did.
Well, because they're mixed. You got to mix the soda with the alcohol, no?
Well, the interesting thing is all the sodas had already been invented for the most part. There seemed to be one or two like little tiny brands that popped up. Some breweries switched over. We know some wine producers switch over to producing like juices and things like
well, there was an idea that there was going to be an increase in sales and a lot of different things, and that there was going to be an increase in like people going to the movies or people trying to find leisure or fun or activities in other realms, but then that ends up not being the case, right? And that everything suffers, like people aren't going to the movies, people aren't going, I don't know, bowling.
But then speakeasies become really great, right?
That's what people end up doing instead.
Not only can you drink, but now you're going to this new place where you can listen to some music you've never heard before, mm-hmm. and maybe have sex with somebody of another race or ethnicity.
All of the fun things happening
or another
all
gender
in one place.
That you would never have thought of doing before.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, woohoo.
It's a one-stop shop.
Right. It's like, I'm already a scofflaw. I might as well break these other things that I thought I
might as well just hit a home run with this. Right. And there we go. Romanticizing the era.
It's hard. It's complicated. It is. So prohibition's repealed. Well, not repealed. 1933 March, the Cullen-Harrison Act legalizes beer and wine, which is what, you know, remember, that's why Wilson had like vetoed the Volstead Act to begin with.
It was
like,
not beer and wine.
Beer and wine weren't supposed to be there. But by December 5th, 1933, the 21st Amendment's ratified. It nullifies the 18th Amendment. I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. Does prohibition contribute to the Depression? Well, the legalization of alcohol does not get us out of the Depression.
No.
So I don't know.
Only the war can do that.
You know, it's rarely in history is a direct cause and effect, though. So
that's true. Yeah.
Maybe we shouldn't even be trying to make anything of that. But, well, I think this has been a fun conversation.
Very fun.
We bounced all over the place. I know there's stuff we didn't cover that we both wanted to talk about, like Carrie Nation and kind of the origins of Prohibition and stuff. But maybe we'll return to this and kind of talk about kind of early women's movements in the U.S. and we can kind of talk about
there's
that.
Certainly a lot to tease out here still, particularly as we go into this new 21st century 20s, right? Like we're in the 20s now and there's just so much to...
The 2020s.
There's so much to cover. One small tidbit, though, before we go, I loved this, was that in 1929, the mayor of Berlin visits New York City. 1929, 9 years after Prohibition's taken effect. And he asks, so when is the Prohibition law going to go into effect? Because it's just so, I mean... It's so blatant in 1920. It's just everybody's drinking. There's nothing that's regulating it, really. And he asks, so when's that going to actually take effect? And they're like, I love that. I laughed out loud when I read that.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great final word on the topic. Thanks for joining us this week on An Incomplete History. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Hillary.
Until next time. Goodbye.